never as bad as what you just witnessed. I've always kept it from blowing up. The Chet I took yesterday, the one that almost got me killed, was my first. I didn't know I shouldn't take that much. How have you avoided a full-blown panic until today? Done anything dangerous to trigger adrenaline and combat the panic? I stare at his profile. How did you know? He turns to me with eyes that could pull me out to sea. Adrenaline doesn't always work. You think I was carrying those Chets around for you? Oh. Something about his admission makes me feel better. We're more alike than either of us wants to acknowledge. I know where I stand with him. He doesn't lie to me. He tells me exactly what he'll do if I don't go along with the Gates of Dawn's plans. No guessing. We're friendly, for now. But that ends if I ever decide that his cause isn't for me. Raikin, Daltrey, and Dune make more and more sense the longer I'm around them. What if I were in a position of power? Could I make the kind of changes that would save Secondborns? If so, isn't that worth the fight? Or is that the Chet talking? The price of power is my brother's life, at the very least. Many more people would have to die for Dune and Raikin to attain the influential positions they would need to topple the Fates Republic. The most likely outcome of the plot to destroy the Fates Republic is that we'll all be tortured and killed for treason. I don't care about any of it now, though. And I know that's the Chet talking. Are you hungry? I ask. Very, he admits. Me too. Did you know that I can order anything I want here and they'll send it to me? Anything. I don't even need merits. I can have as many Krellas as I want. Do you like Krellas? I love them, I admit, and then whisper. I don't even know most of the food items on the food dispensary's menu. He smiles. It might be the first time I've ever seen him smile. I feel like I ate an entire Chet. What don't you know? His dark eyebrow raises in a cunning arch. What's foie gras? He stifles a chuckle. It's duck liver. Or goose liver. I wrinkle my nose. It sounds gross. Do you like it? No, it has a peculiar aftertaste. If I'm stuck with you until tonight, I say, I'm going to make you my official translator. I rise and walk toward the kitchen. Over my shoulder, I ask, coming? He catches up, his hand brushing past mine, though he doesn't seem to notice. First, let's put Phoenix back together. He can be our official taste tester. The theoretical joy of a food fest just lost some of its appeal, but I try to shrug off the sense of dread at the thought of being intentionally poisoned. Phoenix is still lying inoperable on the table. Raikin opens the case he carries in his pocket. He extracts a star-shaped programmer and inserts it into one of Phoenix's ports. The star whirls until it resembles a sun. When it winds down, I ask, what was that? That was a stockpile of malevolence, he says with a smug smirk. He motions for me to help him, and together Raikin and I reassemble the Mechadome. After lifting it from the table and rebooting it, Raikin gives it a series of voice commands through his moniker. He tells it to terminate the vases on the bureau, and Phoenix waddles over to them, lifts its vacuum arm, and emits short bursts of air that topple over each small urn one at a time. Shards of glass scatter on the floor. I liked those, I mutter. I'll buy you new ones, Raikin replies, just like a privileged firstborn who has no idea of the value of things like that. They're not exactly mine. Raikin orders the bot to suck up the pieces. The Mechadome performs each order without a hitch, but its hover mode is still broken. I can't test its new weapons in here. We'll have to do it later. Good. I'm running out of vases. Phoenix, Raikin says, go to the kitchen. The Mechadome trundles away. After you, Raikin says, gesturing me forward. I go to the command center in the kitchen, where we peruse the food dispensary's menu. Raykin explains several dishes to me, some of which I order, like the puff pastries in the shape of swans and the pan-seared whitefish in truffle butter sauce. Others, like the snails sautéed in their shells and the fried beef tongue, I want to mark so that I never accidentally order them. Raykin carefully feeds a small bit of each delivered dish to Phoenix as they arrive. With two fully laden platters that would make an epicure jealous, we move to the den and set them on the low graphite table in front of the sofa. The lights are dim, and the visual screen is muted. Sitting cross-legged on the soft carpet, I pass Raykin a plate, silverware, and a napkin. He sits on the floor across from me. He piles food on our plates. I almost die of happiness at the bite of cheese-encrusted potatoes that he insists I taste from his fork. He leans forward and feeds it to me. "That might be my favorite thing ever," I murmur. "I told you," he replies, a smug grin on his lips. We would have killed for even a small pouch of this at the Stone Forest base. "You don't have food like this?" I give an unladylike snort. No, we had nothing like this. "Did you ever go hungry?" "Sometimes, in combat, when rations ran low and the supply carriers were shot down." We both know that it was his side who shot them down. Rebels. Gates of Dawn. The enemy. I can see he's thinking the same thing. "You know who'd like this the most?" I ask. He shakes his head. "Edgerton. That man can eat. It doesn't matter what. He's just hungry all the time." I set my fork down. "Are Edgerton and Hammond okay?" Raykin nods. "There." I hold up my palm. "Don't tell me where they are. They're safer if I don't know." "They're like family to you, aren't they?" I think of the two sword soldiers who showed me the ropes when I first arrived at the Stone Forest base. "No, they're better than family." "They're doing well. Hammond is healthy, experiencing a normal pregnancy." Tears cloud my eyes, but I force them back. Swallowing hard, I nod. Raykin wearily scrubs his face with his palms. "Edgerton is a problem, though." My eyes narrow. "Why?" He drops his hands and looks at me. "He's too mountain, for lack of a better term. He doesn't blend in well. When he opens his mouth, you know where he's from."
"Can you teach him to hide it better?"
"Mags is doing what she can. If anyone can help him, it's her." I nod, thinking of Raykin's enigmatic second-born assistant. I must look worried because he says, "There's nothing more you can do for them now. Our network will take care of your friends." I flop back, stretching out on the carpet. I know. Raykin crawls around to my side of the table, lying down beside me. He turns toward me, resting on his side. I do the same, meeting his gaze. The weariness of being awake for so long shows on his face. I wait for him to say something. He doesn't. He just stares back, his eyelids drooping. I whisper, "You never told me how you know Grisham." Raykin's eyes open again, and he yawns. "My father sent me to the best schools in Purity. Grisham and I were in some of the same circles. He is younger than me. He used to follow me around because I was the best fusion blade fighter, thanks to Daltrey's instruction on my time off. Grisham has a fascination with weapons, and a serious obsession with betting, especially on the secondborn trials. Grisham always tries to get me to help him figure out who will be the winner. He even offered me a seat on his council in exchange for my insight."
"His Halo Council?" I ask.
"Mm-hmm," he answers with a deep murmur. His eyes droop again.
"Are you going to take his offer?"
"Mm-hmm."
"Does Grisham ever win when he bets on the trials?"
"Yes."
Raykin closes his eyes. His breathing becomes heavier.
"Will it be hard for you to betray him?" I ask. But Raykin is already asleep.
Chapter 5. Ebb Tide. He's not going to show. I lie in the center of the sparring circle, staring up at the intricate golden ceiling of Grisham's training facility. Lifting my hand, I stare at my moniker's timekeeper. Grisham is officially 3 hours late for his scheduled training. I think it's safe to say he's never coming. He has been a no-show to every single session I've scheduled for him in the past few days. I rise to my feet and climb the golden steps to the balcony. Nothing stirs here but the breeze from the sea. I wander out onto the shimmering terrace. The stone is veined with gold, glinting in the morning sun. The blue sky, uncluttered by airships, which are restricted from flying near the Halo Palace, still holds the warmth of summer here, even as we have slipped into autumn. The view overlooks the stone stairs that wind through the jagged cliff to the water below. I pull off my protective wrist shields and hauberks, setting them aside. My sleeveless Under Armour top and lightweight leggings are warm enough for a jog along the shore. Descending the uneven steps to the sandy beach, I discard my footwear. My toes sink into the white, powdery grit. I stroll to the water. It's always a shock, the coolness of the sea as it settles around my ankles. I remember my first view of the ocean with Hawthorne and wonder what he's doing right now, if he's all right, if he's alive. My heart burns from the agony of not knowing. I turn my gaze toward the cliff again. Lavish white silken tents topped with streaming golden pennants stand ready along the shore, erected on the off chance that one of the firstborn residents of the palace will need to use them. None of them does. I'm alone, the only visitor. Secondborn stone-faded attendants stand near the tents to cater to firstborn royalty. I lift my hand to acknowledge them. Their heads lean together in suspicion, trying to figure out why secondborn Roselle St. Sismode is in the Fate of Virtues when she should be off fighting the Gates of Dawn. I've been treated like an extreme outsider by all the secondborns I've encountered since I arrived. No one speaks to me. It's as if they fear me, but why, I can only guess. I jog along the shore in the direction I haven't explored yet. The tide is ebbing. It's peaceful, and I hardly break a sweat in the 30 minutes it takes to reach the end of the inlet. Rounding the high cliff wall of the cove, I slow to a halt. Ahead, tall stone spires reach toward the sky from a small island in the middle of the sea. Waves crash around the jagged rocks and slate-colored stone walls. The retreating water uncovers a sandbar that leads to the arching gates of the medieval fortress. I'm captivated by the triangular white flags on the forbidding parapets, each pennant adorned with a silver halo. The arching mouth of the castle is open. Heavy doors with a seafoam patina stand wide. A slow procession of women emerges from the yawning maw of the castle. They travel toward the shore along a small strip of sand. At the center of the parade, a young blonde woman in a flowy white dress wades gracefully through the shallow surf, holding her long skirt in her hand, exposing her ankles to the sunlight. Death literally hovers over her in the form of 10 black, bat-winged death drones. The drones cast cold shadows onto the sand and water around her. Seagulls fall silent as they near, scattering in the presence of the drones. A team of secondborns scurries around the beach. Stone-faded workers set up tents and awnings and direct a hovering easel into place. A half-executed oil painting adorns the canvas in a palette of bright hues. Paintbrushes of various sizes levitate next to the easel. Secondborns with the white roiling wave monikers of the Fate of Seas amble around, digging up clams and throwing out nets and woven traps. Before I can circumvent the party, the young woman in the white dress drops her hem, allowing water and sand to soak it as she hurries to me. The death drones follow her. "Roselle St. Sismode," she gushes. "I'd heard rumors that you'd come to Virtues." Recognition dawns abruptly. It's Balmora, a younger version of her mother, Adora. "Hello, Secondborn Commander," I reply with a deep nod of my head. Balmora Virtue, formerly Wen Bowie, before her transition, is hardly ever photographed or shown on the visual screen. As the spare heir to the title of the Virtue, she's kept from the public eye so as not to be a distraction to the true heir. Her second-born, virtue-fated attendants move away from us to a discreet distance, but their eyes and ears are all tuned to our conversation. Based on their upscale attire and silver halo monikers, I'd guess they're second-borns of other prominent families and virtues. All but one of them, a second-born stone-fated girl around the age of 12. She hovers near Balmora. "How long has it been since I last saw you at the Sword Palace?" Balmora asks. "I was 10, so 9 years ago?" I ask. "That sounds about right. I was 11, I believe." "I'm surprised you remember me." Her eyes grow wide.
"I remember you quite vividly, Roselle. How could I forget? You smashed a clock over Grisham's head.
I also see you almost every day on the visual screen, running through a barrage of explosions or shooting at your enemies." She holds up her hand with her thumb up and two fingers out in the shape of a fusion mag, popping off rounds. Her pouty mouth curls into a snarl. She isn't mocking me. It's more like admiration.
"That isn't real. Those are just Salloway Munitions ads."
"Yeah, but you've got to meet firstborn Derek Burgeon."
My brow wrinkles. "I'm sorry, who?"
"The soldier? The one who lifts you up at the end of that one ad and carries you to the waiting airship?"
She wraps her arms around herself in an embrace.
"I remember the ad. It depicted a scenario very much like Hawthorne's rescue of me from the battlefield in Stars."
"I didn't catch that diamond's name," I reply.
"If I were that close to Diamond Derek, I would definitely remember his name."
She holds her hand to her heart with a dreamy expression. I frown. He's okay. It's just, it wasn't real.
The real Derek, if put into a situation with megaton bombs exploding in actual combat, would probably wet himself and never leave the airship. He'd be cringing in the corner beneath his artificial helmet of hair products, crying and sucking his thumb. It's men like Hawthorne and Rakan, who repeatedly dive into danger despite the threat to their own lives, that I find attractive. More than attractive. Irresistible.
"Do you think he'll visit you here?"
"Who?"
She rolls her eyes.
"Derek!"
"No."
"That's a shame. I was hoping you'd introduce me to him."
She pushes out her lower lip.
"Sorry, Secondborn Commander."
She waves her hand.
"Please, call me Balmora. Secondborn Commander is so formal."
Her grin stretches wide, showing her perfect teeth.
"When did you arrive?"
Her fingers catch her windswept hair from her cheek, tucking the long blonde strands behind her ear.
"A little over a week ago."
"Why are you here?" she blurts out.
"No one knows. It's the most delicious question on everyone's lips."
She moves forward and links her arm in mine with a familiarity that I cannot fathom. We've only met that one other time. Back then, Balmora had been more interested in Gabriel than me. One of the death drones breaks formation and veers closer to me. Turning its harrowing gun barrels in my direction, its initiating whine sends my hand to the hilt of my fusion blade.
"Step away from the second-born commander," it warns in a rumbling robotic tone.
I can see my reflection and Balmora's on the drone's veneer. My fingertips slowly ease the hilt from the leather sheath secured to my thigh.
"Stand down," Balmora orders her security drone with a wave of her arm, as if swatting away a nagging insect. "This is my friend, Roselle St. Sismode."
The drone takes a moment to process her words before it powers down and shifts away to join the others in formation.
"Now then, let's go for a walk," Balmora continues, holding on tighter to my arm.
I relax my grip on my fusion blade, replacing it in its sheath. We stroll the shore together. The young girl trails behind us. Balmora seems not to notice.
"Don't mind my sentinels," she says. "I rarely have visitors. The drones are unaccustomed to new faces."
I glance again at her
sentinels. They aren't sword stingers, like the ones that guard Grisham. Stingers are meant to defend. Death drones are meant to kill. It's their only job. I wonder if they're protecting Balmora, or if they're her prison guards, ready to kill her if she tries to slip away. Do you live here? I nod my head in the direction of the stone fortress amid the waves. Balmora's smile fades as her gaze goes to the enormous structure surrounded by water.
The sea fortress? It's the Secondborn Commander's residence.
She counters with a sharp note of bitterness.
Where else would I live?
It's lovely. It's something from a fairy tale. The water is clear enough to see the coral reefs. Diamond patterns dance on the weathered stone. The spires are topped with silver tiles that sparkle in the sunlight.
It is, but it's also very lonely.
She sighs with the kind of melancholy I remember from my days living at the Sword Palace. But I had no companions. She has several. The gaggle of females follows us, whispering behind their hands. Balmora tightens her grip on my arm.
They're not good company, she hisses. They're no better than spies. One must watch everything one says around them. And anyway,
they're boring. The only one I can trust is Quincy. Balmora indicates the freckle-faced 12-year-old behind us.
You'll have to visit me while you're a resident of my father's home. Which reminds me, you haven't yet told me why you're here.
She holds her breath while she waits for me to answer. It gives me pause. I'm to assume firstborn Malcolm Burton's position as Grisham's mentor. Her expression turns incredulous.
You are going to instruct Grisham in the art of warfare?
She giggles and tries to smother it with her hand. Yes.
And how is he taking that?
She asks, wiping a stray mirthful tear from the corner of her eye.
Not well, I reply, straight-faced. I should think not. His overinflated ego won't stand for a secondborn telling him anything, let alone a young woman half his size.
His ego is in for a beating, then. She snorts.
And my father knows about this?
He's the one who gave me the job.
If only I could be around to see that,
she says wistfully. Come to Grisham's sparring facility tomorrow and see for yourself. I could teach you both at the same time, if he ever shows up for training.
She gives me a side-eyed look. You're not serious.
Why not?
Her cheeks puff out as she exhales. I can think of a few reasons. First, I'm not allowed inside the Virtue's Palace, or even beyond this beach, without his invitation. Second, I'm not allowed anywhere near Grisham. And third, I'm forbidden by law to train in the art of war unless I become Firstborn Commander.
You're confined there?
I cast my eyes out to the sea fortress once more. You see that stone formation ahead?
She asks me, gesturing to jagged rocks on the beach.
That's the farthest I can go without creating chaos among the Exo and Iono guards on the estate.
She's their prisoner. We're not so different, she and I. Secondborns to the two most powerful clarities in the world. But unlike me, Balmora's family wants her alive, in case something happens to Grisham. Mine wants me dead, so there will be no alternative to Gabriel.
What do you do here all day? I ask. Do you have a job of some sort?
She shakes her head.
I have no duties and few interactions with anyone, apart from my staff and the occasional visitor. But now that you're here, you can be my special friend and come for tea and tell me about all the things you're doing out there in the world.
I'd hardly call the Halo Palace the world. It's more like the most privileged island in the world.
Please say you'll come.
I'll come when I can, I reply. On the walk back, she chats nonstop about her visit to the Sword Palace when we were children, her memories of me and of Gabriel. It's clear that she has romanticized that time, talking about Gabriel as if he's the most heroic person she has ever met. I try not to become irritated. I'm not really mad at her. I'm mad at our parents and society for turning the chivalrous boy into a bitter man. When we near her easel, she shows me her oil painting. To my untrained eye, it's exquisite, the exact likeness of the castle in the sea before us. This is beautiful, Balmora. You're an artist. I'm not allowed to be an artist, she replies, her lips pouting. But I know my compliment has made her happy, because her mood changes quickly, and she pounces on my arm once more. You have to let me paint your portrait! I won't take no for an answer. But I said I won't take no for an answer! I don't know the first thing about sitting still. No, you wouldn't, would you? She giggles. We'll figure something out. She needles me until I say yes, and I spend the next few hours watching her paint the castle. She teaches me about perspective, using a focal point to determine the angles and lines. It's fascinating. I use focal points to target and kill. She uses them to capture and create. We have a small picnic together, set up by her second-born staff on the beach under a luxurious awning with tables and chairs and linens. We sit apart from the other second-born women, who talk quietly among themselves about the upcoming second-born trials and their favorite diamond-faded actors. I pick at my food, afraid to try anything not tested by Phoenix first. I only eat the finger foods from the same plates as Balmora, even when she tries to offer me things she's not eating. A part of me feels stupid and paranoid. Another part of me knows everyone is a potential enemy. Balmora grills me about life at the Sword Palace, and especially about Gabriel. She listens to my tales recollecting his childhood games and acts of chivalry. These are the only stories I can give her, because after the age of 11, I hardly ever saw him. She laps them up like the pastry cream on her fingertips. Do you want some advice? Balmora asks as she wipes her hands with her napkin. She has a smile much like her mother's, though more sublimely impish than wickedly beautiful. I don't know. Depends on what we're talking about. I set my napkin aside. My brother hates to be embarrassed above all else. If you want him to do what you tell him, that's your leverage. I think about it for a moment. Thanks. The tide is fully out now, and the sea castle is completely exposed. The sun is scorching. It's so much warmer here than in Swords. By this time of year, we'd be issued heat-regulated armor. I should wear a bathing suit the next time I come to the beach. The dishes are just being cleared by mechadomes when combat airships suddenly fly by overhead. The teacups tremble on their saucers. I shield my eyes and track them. They're new, heavily armored troop carriers. By the look of them, they have multiple types of guided missiles and advanced combat weaponry. The Salloway munition signature is in every sophisticated line of the airships. Clifton is nothing if not meticulous when it comes to his products, and I would know his designs anywhere. What is it? Balmora asks. Several more fly over in combat formation. We should get off the beach, I warn, as I get to my feet. Why? Balmora asks. She doesn't seem the least bit alarmed. Something's happening. Something's not right. The death drones blare and move into a tighter formation, herding the second-born women into a circle around us. Some scream and overturn their chairs, skittering to get away from the drones. I remain calm. In a few seconds, the noise cuts off. Some of the women are crying. Airships with arsenals pointed away from the beach hover above the water in defensive positions. They appear to be protecting the Halo Palace and the Sea Fortress. On both sides of the beach, guards uniformed in black and gray swarm onto the sand, moving in our direction, fusion rifles resting just below their shoulders. They don't have their weapons trained on us, so I know we're not the targets. They scan the water and the cliff's edges through the scopes on their tactical weapons. A death drone breaks formation and flies menacingly close to Balmora. In its robotic voice, it orders, Second-born commander, return to your residence for lockdown. What's going on? Belmora retorts with a scathing look. She's not frightened, not like her attendants. The first wave of Exo guards from the Halo Palace makes it to us. The highest-ranking officer steps to me. With his forearm raised to his mouth, he speaks into his moniker.
Secondborn Commander secure. We've also located Secondborn Roselle's sword.
The holographic soldier projected from his moniker says, Commander Codaline's orders are to protect Roselle's sword and bring her to the safe area. The firstborn sword Exo frowns.
What about the secondborn commander?
Secondborn commander will be shown to her residence by her security detail. The lead soldier nods, ends the communication, and drops his forearm.
Roselle's sword, you're to come with us, he states.
Balmora's death drones surround her and her entourage, aggressively prodding the secondborn virtue-fated women to retreat to the sea castle. Something's wrong. Belmora is the most important secondborn here, isn't she? And yet they're more concerned about securing me than her. Of course, the orders did come from Dune, but it's still counterintuitive.
Promise you'll come visit me!
Belmora calls in a desperate plea as the drones urge her away. I give her a quick nod, so she'll stop resisting and return to her home. She smiles and turns away, moving at an unhurried pace across the sandbar toward her towering fortress of stone. Chapter 6. Crow Sights Carrion. A horde of security personnel forms a wall, cutting me off from Belmora. I've no choice but to go with the soldiers back to the Halo Palace. We run across the sand toward shelter on the clifftop. The stone stairs are just ahead, but we don't use them. A concealed elevator in the face of the rock opens behind the colorful tents. The head Exo and 10 of his detail all cram into the elegant lift, with me at the center. The rest of the unit falls back and waits. The doors close, and we rocket up to the main level of the Halo Palace. We emerge from the marble belly of the giant sea god statue. Its head and beard resemble an ancient mariner's, and its torso merges into the tail of a merman. A downward-thrusting trident is in his grip, frozen as if just before slaying us all. I'm escorted to Grisham's private residence. Cutting through his seaside garden sanctuary next to the formal rose garden, we enter the arching doorways into a labyrinth of indoor bathing pools and bubbling spas. The walls and floors are tiled in mosaics of gold and lapis. Vaulted ceilings and archways are supported by columns carved with mythical sea creatures. The soldiers' footsteps echo through the bathing chambers. Diamond patterns of light reflect off the water in waves. We come upon a hall with a glass-domed ceiling. It features the largest, deepest pool at its center. To one side, smaller, hot pools bubble and flow together, forming a river with waterfalls. A golden walkway made to resemble shells separates the steaming water from the enormous, cooler pool. Exotic plants and flowers infuse the room with intoxicating scents. On the other side of the domed hall, posh furniture arranged in clusters circumscribes a lounging area. The floor is glass. Water flows beneath it. A bar of pure glass gleams near the far wall, a massive aquarium in which vibrantly glowing jellyfish undulate in the calm water. Lighted glass shelves occupy each side. High-end bottles of alcohol line the pristine shelves. Lighted from behind, the bottles smolder with a unique fire. Seated around a circular table by the bar are Grisham and 6 of his entourage. The firstborn commander is appropriately attired in a dark purple swimsuit with a loose shirt, unbuttoned to expose his tanned chest. His companions, all male except for one female, are similarly dressed. Cards are strewn about the table. Sweating bar glasses with colorful liquors and ice cubes infused with gold leaf shavings chill on frosted stone coasters. Blue, green, red, and yellow plumes of cigar smoke hover in the air. Among the firstborns at the table, the bare-chested one in the black bathing suit catches my eye. He's fitter and more handsome than the others. His dark hair is wet and slicked back, and his eyes rival the sublime aquamarine of the pool. The moment Rakin spots me, his shoulders lower, and he eases back against his chair with a look of relief. The expression vanishes almost immediately behind a green puff of smoke he exhales. When he sees me with the guards, Grisham's eyebrows lower, slashing together.
They managed to find you alive, Roselle. I was giving odds on it, after the events of a few nights ago. They weren't very good odds.
He sets his cards face down on the onyx table and gets to his feet. To the leader of the Exo Guards, he says,
"You're dismissed."
The Exo team leader walks forward, pointing his fusion rifle down and away from the heir to the Fate.
"We have orders to stay with the Secondborn sword and keep her safe."
"Safe from what?" I ask. "What's happening?" Grisham scowls in derision, scoffing at my ignorance. "Didn't you hear? Rasmussen Keating was found dead."
Grisham snorts rudely. "You don't know who the Keatings are, do you, Roselle?"
"They're the second family of virtues," I reply. "Firstborn Rasmussen Keating is third in line to the title of the Virtue, just behind you and Balmora.
How did he die?"
"He was murdered," Grisham replies. "Why do you think there are guards everywhere?" His disdain eats at me a little, and my pulse leaps.
"How? By whom?"
"If we knew that, none of us would be on lockdown. We'd be out at the Secondborn Trials training camps, evaluating the stock." His crudeness makes me want to cut his lips off with my sword. I don't touch the hilt of it, lest I'm tempted to follow through with the urge. I mutter, "How tedious for you."
Grisham stares at the guards. "You'll leave this hall, secure the baths from outside. We don't need you hovering."
The jaw of the Exo's leader tightens.
"I'm under orders to remain with Secondborn Roselle's sword."
"Whose orders?"
"Commander Codaline's."
"What a surprise," Grisham says. "She'll be fine. She can probably slaughter all of us."
His eyes drift to Raken.
"Not him, though."
Grisham points at the star across the table.
"He can cut her into a pile of flesh in less than 60 seconds.
I want to refute that claim, but I remain silent. I haven't sparred with Raken. We have no way of knowing who is better.
"I wouldn't dream of it," Raken retorts with a pirate smile, holding up his hand in a show of humorous surrender.
"I might fix her a drink, though."
"Wait outside," Grisham orders the Exos between gritted teeth. When they don't move immediately, he roars,
"Now!"
I turn to go with them, but Grisham growls,
"You stay."
The lead Exo and his armed men retreat from the sweltering hall. The scrawny, ferret-faced firstborn next to Raken punches him in the arm. Raken doesn't seem to notice, but the other firstborn immediately regrets it, rubbing his knuckles with his other hand.
"How come your parents let you train in weapons with a mentor? Didn't they like you?"
the weaseling man asks. Raken's smile never falters, but his eyes turn cold.
"You forget, Simont. My parents had more than one backup for me. I think they loved my third-born brother best."
The bitterness in his tone is thick. Radix was really fifth-born, and Raken loved him.
"They got theirs, old man,"
Grisham says in a soft, conciliatory tone. "Senses brought justice and gave you back your dignity." The aqua light in Raken's eyes dims. There's darkness, and then there are the things that inhabit darkness. Raken's one of those things. I know how he really feels about his murdered brother and parents. It led him to the battlefield in Stars, to slaughter as many swords as he could until they took his life. But he didn't die, because I wouldn't let him. His anger toward his family is a mask he wears, to keep his position and protect his other younger brothers. He's a star floating in the abyss, and a part of me wants to save him from it. Raken gracefully rises from his seat in a slow uncoiling of muscle and sinew.
"I don't believe we've met. I'm Raken Winterstrom."
The other firstborn's laughter sets my teeth on edge. They think he's mocking me. No other firstborn here would think to stand for a secondborn. His outstretched hand is an invitation. I straighten my shoulders. Moving forward, I take his hand. He lifts mine to his lips, kissing the back of it. A small shiver slips through me. Roselle's sword, I murmur with a small curtsy. His fingers linger on mine a bit too long. I pull my hand back. The firstborn man next to Grisham clears his throat. Pushing his chair out, he slaps the top of his thighs with his hands. Why don't you come sit here, Roselle? The crowd erupts in laughter again, but it's quickly silenced by Rakin's frown. You should be thanking her for her service, Karen. Oh, I'd like to thank her for her service, the moon-faded man replies, leering at me. He can't be older than 20. If he were a second-born sword, I'd simply punch him in the teeth. But these aren't second-borns. Retaliation is ill-advised. Rakin holds out his chair. The harmony of his skin over defined muscles is distracting. You can have my seat. I frown. I want to say no. He should probably be ignoring me. But maybe this is better. I don't know that I can hide the intimacy between us, so establishing an acquaintance could conceal our true relationship. Thank you, I reply, and take a step in his direction. No one sits here without a suit, Grisham drawls with a smug smile. Even this high-born second-born. He mocks me with an oxymoron. Rakin takes it in stride. There's a wardrobe closet just over there, Roselle. You can change while I order you a drink.
Get me one, too, the red-headed woman next to Grisham says.
What do you want, Syndra? Rakin asks.
Something lethal, she replies with a wide grin.
Her ice cubes clink together as she raises what's left of the last drink to her full lips. She watches me over the rim of her glass. Condensation drips onto her skin, sliding down the valley between the sides of her ruby-colored bikini top. She wipes it away with her finger. Her moniker resembles a carbon atom. Lights representing protons and electrons orbit over her hand. Rakin nods. He touches his holographic shooting star. A command screen projects from it. He locates a bar menu and orders drinks. Flying mechadomes rise into the air by the bar, selecting bottles of alcohol and setting them on the glass in front of the automated bartender. I drift away in the direction of the wardrobe closet. Entering it, I lock the door behind me. Facing the holographic mirror, I touch the menu on the side. My reflection wears the first bathing suit on the list, a tiny black bikini. I swipe it away. The next one is white and even more revealing. I scoff. After swiping 20 more to the side, it's clear that the only suits in this program are meant for style rather than function, possibly for Grisham's special late-night friends. I settle for a shimmering metallic silver bikini top with matching bottoms and a graphite wrap skirt. The ensemble arrives in a silver box. Inside, the outfit is wrapped in delicate, lavender-scented tissue paper and tied with a graphite-colored satin ribbon. I lift the package from the box that ferried it through the air-driven conveyor in the wall, toss my clothes in, and send them back into the chute to be laundered. Once suited up, I adjust my fusion blade's sheath so that it wraps around my right thigh. Slipping the hilt of the sword into the black straps, I leave the wardrobe. Four of Grisham's friends grin as I approach. Grisham, seated at the onyx table, scowls at me from head to toe. Rakin's face darkens with a frown of disapproval. Syndra raises an appraising eyebrow. My fingers twitch near my fusion blade. A hovering drone delivers a tumbler to the table in front of Rakin. A slice of lemon floats in the center of clear liquid and gold leaf ice cubes. As I join him, he stands and holds out his chair. I settle in opposite Grisham. Rakin pulls another chair away from a nearby table and squeezes it in between me and the ferret-faced man, making Simont scoot over. Rakin seats himself close to my side. On the other side is a firstborn with a blonde cowlick in front. His belly pushes down a rather loud, maize-colored swimsuit as he leans toward me. He extends his hand in a way that leaves me wondering if I should kiss its sun moniker or slap it away. I choose to do neither. His cheeks turn ruddy at the slight. Ahem. He clears his throat, dropping his hand. Allow me to introduce myself. I'm... Shove off, Milken, the firstborn next to him says as he strokes his dark beard. The light from his aqua cresting wave moniker makes it look as if one could surf his hairy chin. She'll never be interested in you. If Milken's bluster is any indication, then he's genuinely offended. I'm a firstborn heir to the most powerful growing operations in the fate of suns. Why wouldn't a secondborn be interested in me? The bearded man leans back in his chair, propping an elbow on the backrest. The wave of his sea's moniker crashes over and over. I heard a rumor that she's not going to be secondborn for long. His appraising eyes make me feel more naked than the locker room in my air barracks ever did, but I try to hide it. She's going to be the sword one day, and your plantations won't mean a thing when she's in control of all of our armies. Milken's soft cheeks puff out. She'll always have the secondborn taint on her, though. That never goes away. True, Raykin agrees. A secondborn will always be inferior. His knee nudges mine beneath the table. An apology. I step on his toes with my bare heel, grinding them as hard as I can. He stifles a small grunt and edges his foot from beneath mine. I almost need to bite my tongue to keep from cursing Milken out. Thank you, gentlemen, for your concern for my brother's well-being, but he's in good health and liable to outlive all of you. Gabriel is as good as dead, Grisham replies with an amused look. It's time that everyone at this table knows it, especially you, Roselle. These are my closest advisors, part of my Halo Council, except for Raykin, of course. But he'll be added soon enough. You'll be called upon to advise us when you're not presiding over the Sword Heritage Council. My father has already anointed you. Now it's just a matter of killing your brother. He says it as if he has accepted the truth of it. My stomach churns. I was counting on turning him into an ally on this one issue. I know you and Gabriel were never friends, Grisham, I acknowledge, but he's firstborn. He'd stand by your side and defend you, no matter what. Grisham lifts an eyebrow. You always surprise me, Roselle. That's not difficult, I think. You never see anything coming. A plot is brewing, Grisham continues. For a moment, fear runs rampant through me. Does he know of my involvement with the Gates of Dawn? Please do elaborate, I reply. Initial reports say Rasmussen's death is assassination, Grisham says. Do you suspect his brother Orwell? Raykin asks. It's the logical choice, Grisham replies. Secondborns murder us all the time for power. It's in their nature. I want to pull my hair out. It isn't nature. Most secondborns accept their fates, no matter how unjust. I'm bringing in an expert to get us answers. Grisham tries to hide his grin, and my stomach tightens in dread. He scrapes the cards together in front of him and forms a stack. Choosing two from the top, he positions one against another. When he pulls his hands back, they remain standing. Carefully, he sets another one against them. My specialist should be here any moment to meet with us. The others at the table casually converse about the secondborn trials galas, planned every night for the next few weeks until the opening ceremonies. I listen as Syndra details the glowing electron-inspired dress she had made for an atom-themed party she's attending this evening. Dune has already advised me that I'm to attend the Gods and Goddesses Ball tonight at a sword social club, to be hosted by an aristocrat named Firstborn Shelling. Speculation is high as to whether the parties will go on as planned, despite Rasmussen's murder. I lift my glass to my lips and take a small sip. It's mostly water, with a little bit of alcohol. It won't get me intoxicated. I nearly curse under my breath after I swallow it. I need a bit of the courage that alcohol could provide. Raken is trying to keep me sharp, but a part of me longs for oblivion. The clipped sound of sharp-heeled boots rings in the lofty room, pulling my attention away from Grisham and his house of cards. I set my glass back down on the table. A solitary man approaches us from the entryway. His blonde, slicked-back hair is neatly trimmed. The long black coat that he normally wears is absent, shed for the warm weather of virtues. His crisp white dress shirt and tight black slacks I remember from when I first met him at the Stone Forest base in Swords. When he sees me, Agent Crow's lips stretch across his steely front teeth in a possessive smile. My hand unconsciously goes to the hilt of my fusion blade. Bile rises in my throat. Inky black death tally notches line his temples and neck. His hands are clasped behind his back, and yet I feel as if he has a dagger pressed to my throat. I dare not look at Raken beside me for fear of giving something away. A thought, a connection, anything that might unmask us both. Agent Crow tears his blue eyes away from me and greets Grisham. "Firstborn Commander," he says. His deep voice sends chills down my spine. "I've been briefed by your undersecretary regarding the death of Firstborn Keating. May I offer you my condolences?"
"No," Grisham says. "No condolences necessary. I thought Rasmussen was a pathetic weakling who would ruin virtues if given it to rule. I don't really care if someone wipes out his entire family. What I care about is why he was killed. That's the reason I sent for you, Agent Crow. I have it on good authority that you are relentless in your pursuit of justice." Grisham's eyes flutter to me, and I can only hope that he cannot hear the rampaging thumps of my heart. A ferocious smile curves his lips. He knows my history with Agent Crow, knows of this man's obsession with me.
"You suspect it was something other than an inheritance issue?" Agent Crow asks.
"I wouldn't rule that out." Grisham sets another card against the growing house of cards. "But it could be something much more sinister."
"You believe someone covets the title of Firstborn Commander, by chance?"
Crow's eyes shift from Grisham to me, as if they cannot stay away. His voracious stare takes in my every detail. My mind flashes with images of Agnes Moon, Hawthorne's ex-girlfriend, who helped gain my release from the underground cell where Agent Crow had planned to kill me. Grisham had sent Agent Crow a gift basket of soaps on my behalf once I was freed. Agent Crow used them to bludgeon Agnes to death. My eyes move between Grisham and the census agent. Grisham sets another card up. Its balance is precise, the angle correct. I suddenly feel buried in a cell with no way out. They continue to talk about the murder of Rasmussen Keating, neither knowing many of the details, but I'm no longer listening. A thigh nudges mine. I pretend I don't feel it. I can't look at Raken. Agent Crow will know. He'll see. A part of me believes I'm being irrational. The cold-hearted Crow who drowned his own sister to gain his firstborn status couldn't possibly know anything about Raken. But I stare straight ahead just the same. Without looking up from his house of cards, Grisham asks, "What do you need to start your investigation?"
"I'll need security access to all of your systems," Agent Crow replies.
"That won't be possible, but I can grant you limited access to systems that lie outside the Halo Palace." Agent Crow's eyes smolder, but Grisham doesn't see it because his attention is on setting the next card.
"We can start outside the Halo Palace if you wish," Crow says. "I'm particularly interested in tracking the movements of sword monikers."
"Why swords?" I ask.
"Swords are the second best killers in the Fates."
Agent Crow believes the best to be census agents, like himself. Hunters tracking down thirdborns and terrorizing them before killing them. I disagree. Swords fight other soldiers who have weapons. Census kills unarmed people without the power to fight back.
And swords have the most to gain from the death of Rasmussen.
Not true, I reply. His virtue-fated brother has the most to gain. The next in line after that is...
Kennet Abjorn, the agent states. Your father.
He's not sword-fated.
I know. He's a virtue, but he's your mother's husband, the fated sword.
My mother wouldn't lift a finger to help my father, especially if it were to obtain a position of power above hers.
What about you, Roselle? You're not above suspicion.
Grisham snorts. Someone just tried to have her killed a few nights ago. I think it's safe to say she's not involved in this plot.
With all due respect, you're assuming whoever attempted to kill Roselle is the same person who murdered firstborn Keating,
Agent Crow replies.
They're separate incidents. I'd like to speak with Roselle's sword about the details of the so-called failed attempt on her life.
I don't answer questions, Agent Crow, unless I have... I stop. I was about to say, Dune present, but I don't want him anywhere near this census agent. Agent Crow's eyebrows rise as he waits for me to finish. My family fusion blade back. I couldn't care less about the weapon. It means nothing to me now. But I know it's a trophy for Agent Crow, one he's unwilling to part with. But it has the desired effect of throwing Agent Crow off and giving me a reason not to be alone with him.
I cannot accommodate your request, he says, but you may come and visit it whenever you wish.
He touches its hilt on his hip. Etched upon the hilt is the St. Sismode crest. Roses and vines entwine along its length. Agent Crow's possession of it used to be salt in a wound, but it's only a symbol of bad blood for me now.
And I don't need permission to talk to you.
Raken yawns, stretching his arms with an obnoxious groan. With the unmistakable tone of firstborn privilege, he says,
If I have to sit here for another second and listen to the boring details of your investigation, I might die.
He slaps his palms against the top of the onyx table. The impressive house of cards comes crashing down, prompting Grisham to hiss and scowl at him.
Last one into the pool has to be my slave for a day.
All around me, chairs slide away from the table. The firstborns fight tooth and nail to get to the water. Arms flail, elbows fly, palms cover faces and shove them in opposing directions. Grisham is first in the pool, cannonballing with the biggest splash I've ever seen. The others follow with ungraceful twists and harrowing belly flops. I'm as surprised as Agent Crow at the lack of decorum among this so-called elite. They act like children. Frivolous children. Raken snatches me from my seat with little effort. I clutch him around the shoulders, afraid he'll drop me. His strong fingers grip my thigh. Sweeping me up, he rests me against his abdomen as he runs to the water's edge. The last thing I see before Raken tosses me like a coin into a wishing well is Agent Crow's homicidal expression over Raken's scarred shoulder. The census agent's favorite prey is snatched away once more. I plunge into the cool water and sink down. The whoosh of Raken entering the water just next to me pulls me toward him. As the bubbles clear, his dark hair waves hello to me. Concern lines his fuzzy expression. I press my index finger to my lips, and then I run it across my neck like I'm slitting my own throat. When I point upward to the pool deck, Raken nods. Everyone else is at the surface, treading water. Agent Crow appears at the edge of the pool above, casting a shark-shaped shadow over us. I kick to the surface. Raken emerges just after me. Grisham splashes me in the face.
You were the last one in. You have to be Raken's slave for a day.
That shouldn't be too difficult, I reply, unwrapping my skirt and tossing the sodden fabric to the side of the pool so that it splashes Agent Crow's boots. I can train him at your sparring circle. If we go in the morning, I can cut him in half with my fusion blade and have the rest of my day to myself. Raken chuckles.
Show me the blood I'll bleed. the roguish firstborn replies. He glances at Grisham beside me. You up for this, Grisham?
His tone is a challenge. Between the two of us,